Today on Against the Grain, what sustains radical politics? What keeps resistance to oppression going over the long run? Ted Stoltz finds in the writings of Baruch Spinoza resources that can help socialists and other radicals persevere and carry on with their political struggles. I'm C.S., the philosophy professor and specialist in Spinoza and Marx, joins us, coming right up. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. People rise up in anger. They cry out and gather on the streets and organize in their communities in response to some injustice, something that provokes indignation and outrage. And sometimes this upsurge of protest can go on for some time, for weeks and even months. And then often the demos begin to fizzle out and the anger subsides and a lot of people go back to their everyday lives. So if a key question hovering over radical politics and activism is how to sustain resistance, how to motivate or inspire people to stick with it, then what or who can we turn to for resources, for ideas about how to keep radicals going over the long run? Baruch Spinoza was a 17th century Dutch philosopher who wrote a lot about the human condition, and my guest today has found in Spinoza's writings ideas that he believes can help radicals persevere as radicals. Ted Stoltz is a philosophy professor at Cerritos College in Norwalk, California, and he contributed an article entitled An Ethics for Marxism, Spinoza on Fortitude, to the journal Rethinking Marxism. He's also author of the forthcoming book, Becoming Marxist, Studies in Philosophy, Struggle, and Endurance. Now, Spinoza was born in Amsterdam in 1632. His Portuguese-Jewish parents had moved there to escape persecution. I asked Ted Stoltz what he likes to emphasize about Spinoza's early life.
He was the son of a fruit merchant, so he grew up in a sort of a business climate. In one of his earliest works, called A Treatise on the Improvement of the Understanding, is the customary title, Spinoza reflects that he had sought out various forms of truth and goodness and came to the realization that this isn't necessarily an autobiographical statement on his part, but this is a universal experience that I think reflects in part his autobiography. He realized that wealth and honor and pleasure were fleeting, were inadequate, and the limited biographical materials that have survived, and later biographers have drawn on these, suggest that he was a very sensitive young man. He was not comfortable or satisfied with remaining within the context of his father's business. His brother did pursue that, but Spinoza himself saw the limitations, the constraints of even a successful business. And he was widely regarded as a very precocious student. His Latin teacher, Franciscus van den Enden, was a big influence on him. He became very interested in theater and the arts and may even have acted in some plays that van den Enden produced. So he just seems to have been a very precocious young man who saw the limitations of the life that was laid out for him, and he had a kind of, I guess we could call it an existential crisis or a philosophical conversion. I'm not sure exactly what would be the best way of characterizing it.
At age 17, Spinoza cut short his formal studies to help the family's business. And at age 24, he was excommunicated from the Sephardic community of Amsterdam. Tell us about that.
Well, excommunicated is more of a Christian way of explaining. He fell under a ban by the elders of the Jewish synagogue or community in Amsterdam. And they were in a somewhat precarious situation. If I were thinking along their lines, here's a young radical free thinker who is endangering the stability and respect and toleration that was offered to the Jewish community in Amsterdam. Throughout Europe, there were very few places in which Jews could worship openly and not fear persecution, social isolation. So I think there was a level of discomfort with Spinoza, and it was a mutual parting of the ways, frankly. I think Spinoza was, at that point, not really content to remain within the small circle of friends and family within the Jewish community. He had already met people through his father's business. He had met other individuals just in everyday intellectual pursuits and his studies. So in a way, it sounds harsh to say it was an excommunication or a ban. I would think we could call it a mutual parting of the ways.
Now, we are talking this hour about an article you wrote for the journal Rethinking Marxism. It's called An Ethics for Marxism, Spinoza on Fortitude. And what you're trying to do is draw on resources that you find within Spinoza, within his thought and writing. Resources that might aid what? That might help whom? And I assume, of course, and I know, that this relates to the socialist project, the project of people who have read and understood and taken from Karl Marx.
Yes. Well, I've been an activist most of my adult life, most recently as a union president, as a faculty union president, previously in the anti-apartheid movement, Central America Solidarity, anti-Gulf War movement. And over the years, it occurred to me, it's very difficult, and I think this is true of other activists as well, it's very difficult to sustain a commitment to radical social change, partly because of the ups and downs of movements, partly because of the stresses that activism plays upon each individual emotionally and their friendships and family relationships. Now, Spinoza wouldn't be the only person one could turn to, but I think Spinoza's discussion of the emotions, the affects, to use his technical term, is potentially fruitful for radical activists to think through, on the one hand, what causes people to become motivated to participate within radical political projects, but also what can sustain their commitments, especially in the context of the ups and downs of struggles, and that many of the movements we participate within will not fully achieve what we hope that they will achieve. So it's that unevenness, I think, of the rise and fall of social movements and how activists and organizers can regularly rethink and adjust themselves to that ebb and flow of movements. A very specific recent example, I think, is like many people, I was very supportive of the Bernie Sanders campaign. And even that slogan, to feel the burn, was very contingent on the success of the campaign and forces that we don't always have much control over. So how do you sustain a commitment even past the defeat of Bernie Sanders, or whatever comes after Bernie Sanders?
Socialists should, in an effort to persuade others to join the socialist project, right? I mean, part of what socialists want to do is to build the movement. They should, and they do use facts and arguments. And they also, you write, should rely on emotion. By which you mean what?
Well, I clearly see emotional appeals by musicians, by artists. For many of my generation, music played a very important role, whether it was the Rolling Stones or Bob Dylan or Marvin Gaye. I mean, the ability of music to animate a desire for society to be very different. That's what I would call a utopian element within the arts. or a romantic impulse within much music and art. Of course, there's also music or art that plays upon anger, indignation, rage, a sense of injustice, that things should not be like this, cannot be allowed to remain like this. Also, I think of in public meetings and in public events, there's a tendency for maybe anger or indignation as the more common emotional appeal. The danger, of course, and this is partly why I think Spinoza is important, if you rely simply on anger or indignation to arouse a crowd, it can't easily be sustained. I mean, in the short run, it can be very effective, but my concern is, how do you sustain that kind of emotional appeal? It's extremely short-lived or episodic. That would also be true of utopian and romantic appeals, that people can only live within that euphoric moment of, say, the Occupy movement for a certain period of time, you know, weeks, months, perhaps. But that euphoria will tend to die down, and then there is a return to the ordinary life that we live. So it's this fluctuation of emotions that is the problem that I've observed, and Spinoza, in his Ethics, his great work, especially focuses on this kind of alternation of emotions, the dynamic of the affects between, for example, hope and fear, love and hatred. And if all we are presented with is this fluctuation, we're not really able to build a kind of movement that is going to reach out and sustain itself through these ups and downs of whatever difficulties present themselves to us.
Ted Stoltz joins us on Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. He is professor of philosophy at Cerritos College, and he contributed an article entitled An Ethics for Marxism, Spinoza on Fortitude, to the journal Rethinking Marxism. That essay, that article, is part of a book that will be published next year by Ted Stoltz, by Brill, and the title is, at least right now, Becoming Marxist, Studies in Philosophy, Struggle, and Endurance. So, Ted, if anger and indignation may fade over time, kind of that initial burst of outrage at social injustice may not last long or may fluctuate, then what can Spinoza offer us to help us navigate those fluctuations, or maybe help us deal with those fluctuations so that there is a kind of steadiness, a kind of endurance to what internally can fuel our desire to stay radical and to stay with projects for radical social change?
Yes, that's the big question. And it's difficult to give the kind of detailed response that really would be needed, but let me sketch out sort of a general approach. For Spinoza, the affects can be distinguished into two basic categories. The difference for Spinoza would be some emotions are passive. They happen to us. They're triggered by some outside event or bodily state. And these passive affects or passive emotions would be, for example, anger, hatred, but equally love and hope are passive. They're not active. So Spinoza is concerned that we are not in control of these emotions. They are playing themselves out through us, and that is the concern, that they are not lasting, they're episodic. Spinoza has a different category of affect or emotion, though, that he calls active affects, or active emotions we could use as an equivalent. And he gives the example of what he calls fortitude. And fortitude can be understood in terms of the interrelationship of other active affects, namely courage and generosity. Courage in the sense of reason, not affects themselves, but reason enabling one to reflect upon one's interior states and relationship to the outside world, and strengthening one's resolve to continue to persist in whatever project one has before oneself. Generosity is an affect that again falls under this broader category of fortitude that radiates out to others to wish well upon them, to seek to strengthen their projects, and to join forces with them. So Spinoza thinks that the passive affects are not reliable, and what we need to try to identify is the role of the active affects, fortitude, as the broad category, and falling under that category, generosity on the one hand and courage on the other hand. And so to the extent that we can reflect on the passive affects, we can see the causes of them, we can bring them under somewhat greater control and stabilize them. We can potentially transform hatred into love, fear into hope. There's no guarantee that we will be successful, and there's no complete or final accomplishment because we are still in a society, in a world. Outside of us, things are happening, and it's a somewhat difficult process of maneuvering, this process of finding remedies for the passive affects, strengthening the active affects, bringing a passive life under more active orientation and control.
If understanding the causes of our emotions, of our affects, is important to Spinoza, then what does that mean concretely? And maybe we can take, for an example, an emotion, an affect that Spinoza finds passive, finds unproductive, fear. So if we fear something and we're constantly being told to fear things in our political climate, what might Spinoza, or what would Spinoza have said about understanding the reasons for that and thereby addressing it and maybe moving from passive to active?
Well, the difficulty, of course, is to try to identify the source of the fear. And most fear comes in a much more nebulous or generalized form. Let me give you an example from my own experience in collective bargaining and negotiations. Many years ago, I read a book by Michael Yates called Why Unions Matter, and he has a lovely illustration of being in the heat and the stress and sometimes anger and outbursts of sitting at a negotiating table and being afraid that you're not perhaps fully in control of the situation, because you aren't. You're dealing perhaps in a very anti-union climate, maybe in a concessionary situation, lots of pressures placed upon you. And his recommendation, I think it's very Spinozist, I'm sure he didn't intend it to be, but he suggests you negotiate as if you are looking at the whole process from the ceiling of the room, observing from on high what's going on. And that ability to disengage yourself from the heat of the moment, it's no guarantee you're going to be successful in negotiating. You may not, just as a result of that, come up with a better contract than you had if you're, you know, devolving into a shouting match or something. But it does give you a clarity of thought, a perspective that may be beneficial. So there's no guarantee for Spinoza that to the extent that we try to stabilize passive emotions that we will be successful. We are operating within limits that are placed upon us from forces outside of us.
I'm CS, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Ted Stoltz joins us. His academic research focuses primarily on Baruch Spinoza, the 17th century Dutch philosopher, Karl Marx, and contemporary French and Italian philosophy. And he worked for 5 years as president of his American Federation of Teachers local. And we are talking about something he wrote about Spinoza and Spinoza's notion on fortitude and socialist politics that appeared in the journal Rethinking Marxism. What about outrage against a political system or a political injustice? And, you know, that outrage may not last very long for a variety of reasons. You know, for practical reasons, we may just need to get back to work and deal with our jobs and our families and our personal lives. But what might the concept of fortitude and the subcategories of courage and generosity that you laid out, that Spinoza advocated, what might fortitude do to help us work through that outrage and anger towards something more stable, less fluctuating, and more focused, and more enduring?
Right. I think one of the difficulties here is to distinguish what Spinoza might be talking about and its relevance to radical politics, and I guess what has become rather popular, some notion of grit. I've seen a number of books that have come out with this idea of grit. If only we could exert greater willpower or strength of character, that we will be successful in our personal lives or in business or something along those lines. Spinoza is not suggesting that as isolated individuals, we are going to be able to strengthen our emotional life. I don't take what Spinoza is talking about as a kind of pop psychology for activists, you know, some sort of daily regimen or routine that one goes through. Not that anything would be necessarily wrong with that. I mean, in this sense, Spinoza could be seen as in continuity with a kind of Stoic tradition of regular reflection on one's emotional life. You find this in Marcus Aurelius and Epictetus and Seneca in the ancient world. But I think for Spinoza, really what's needed is to build organizations, is to reach out to others, that the strengthening of one's emotional life can't fully be done by oneself, even through a very regular regimen or routine of reflection. For example, we have to build sustainable movements, political parties, unions, and if we think about fortitude in terms of the courage aspect, that's only one element. The generosity aspect means that we take courage and strengthen our resolve in relationship to others. So there's that dynamic or interplay, that dialectic, we could call it, of courage and generosity. Those who are generous have courage strengthened and vice versa. However, even within very robust, dynamic organizations, there are periods of crisis, there are divisions, there are splits. So even at that level, there are no guarantees. But what I'm trying to suggest is that for Spinoza, it's not a merely psychological analysis of how we can rein in bad impulses or redirect bad impulses into good impulses. It's a question of joining forces with others, and for Spinoza, we increase our power to act in the world to the extent that we identify with, find support and encouragement in organizations with others.
Another thing you bring up in this article in Rethinking Marxism is Spinoza's insistence on the importance of looking for what's good in whatever we come across. Can you elaborate on that?
Yeah, let me give a contemporary example. If you look at the presidential campaign, I think a lot of the liberals and progressives that I know have been unduly terrified by the specter of Donald Trump and those who support him. There is cause to be afraid. There is cause to be concerned. And yet, the ascendancy of Trump suggests, as with the support that people had for Bernie Sanders, that things are not going to continue as they have in the past. There's something new that has emerged. And it's not that I would say there's something good in Trump, but the Trump phenomenon indicates the discontent, the lack of satisfaction with the way U.S. capitalism is going, and it's an opportunity. So the tragedy to me is that I think Bernie Sanders would have been able to and was able to reach the people who were responding to Trump, or at least some of them, and given the nature of the campaign, Hillary Clinton's campaign is simply not, it would appear, interested in trying to reach those people, but rather relying simply on fear or consigning those who support Trump to, you know, simply to exclude them from consideration. Now, I have family members who are sympathetic to Trump, so it is challenging at a personal level to try to find some good out of what can be very, very frustrating conversations. But this is the nature of politics and political debate and discussion, to try to find some good in one's opponent. Not that you're going over to the side of the opponent, but you're trying to strengthen your own arguments in the process. I mean, so I think what Spinoza is saying is a realization that there is neither pure good nor bad in the world. There are relative degrees of good and bad. And even in a very negative situation, a situation of fear, there are bases of hope. Even in a very negative campaign, like the Trump campaign, there are symptoms or indications that there's something more interesting going on that radicals, leftists, can seek to identify and to redirect within limits to their own efforts at a more progressive, egalitarian social transformation.
I want to step back here and talk about Spinoza and his ethics and his ethical project and what it brings to the Marxist, specifically Marxist project. And you bring this up in your article. Maybe as a way of getting into this, we could talk about to what degree you think ethics was a part of Marx, to what degree Marx focused on ethics as opposed to politics and capitalism and economics. What's your take on that?
Well, I've been in, let me take it in two different directions. I've been in socialist organizations, and my first real exposure to an education in socialist ideas was not in an academic setting, but in a socialist organization, Solidarity, which is a small national organization but still exists, and I remain sympathetic to that perspective of socialism from below, which is a term that Hal Draper, who was very closely connected to the Berkeley Free Speech Movement as a librarian at UC Berkeley, that's it, his term socialism from below, or in Marxist politics, the idea that socialism requires the self-emancipation of the working class. The difficulty, however, among Marxists within many of the organizations that I'm familiar with, and to a certain extent within my own experience, that ethics hasn't played the sort of role that it really ought to play. I don't mean that ethics should play the primary role, but so much of the discussion within socialist groups tends to be dealing with a current political issue or a discussion of economics or foreign policy or something along these lines. And there's not enough attention paid to, so why is that wrong? And how ought we to react at a level other than just a factual analysis? So part of my concern is that socialist organizations have not paid enough attention to matters of ethics. But in Marx, you do see, in Marx's early writings, in Marx's political writings, in Capital itself, you see a willingness not just to describe capitalism and the nature of capitalist crises, but to condemn capitalism, to not provide a blueprint of what the alternative might be, what socialism might look like. I don't think Marx was interested in blueprints, but he was a fierce and consistent critic of the injustices of capitalism, the degradation, the lack of dignity that working people experience under capitalist social relations. So I think there's a sort of a disconnect between the socialist organizations that I've been involved in, where there isn't much attention paid to ethics, and yet Marx's writings seem to be filled with moral condemnation of the injustices of capitalism. That doesn't mean that that's all there is in Marx, but I'm suggesting that that is a resource in Marx's writings that contemporary socialists might want to pay attention to. Probably the best example of somebody who tried to do that was an English philosopher named Norman Garris, who wrote eloquently on the need for Marxists to re-engage with ethical reflection, both in a way of criticizing the injustices of capitalism, but also in trying to identify what would be just means to surpass or supersede or replace capitalism. So there's a moral deficit, I think, within many organizations of the left and the socialist organizations that I've been a part of. For all of their good work and intelligent activism, there needs to be that kind of rethinking of those moral resources that we find within Marx's writings. And not just Marx, you find it within Rosa Luxemburg, you find it in Antonio Gramsci, you find it in the Frankfurt School, you find it, you know, as part of the Marxist tradition. Herbert Marcuse would be another example of a Marxist philosopher who was deeply concerned with a moral condemnation of capitalism, not simply a characterization of how capitalism works or capitalist crises, but why capitalism must be challenged and, to the extent that we can, reformed and, we hope, replaced with a much better kind of society or a socialist democracy, if we want to use that term.
Ted Stolze joins us, S-T-O-L-Z-E. He teaches philosophy at Cerritos College in Norwalk, California. And we are talking about an article he wrote called An Ethics for Marxism, Spinoza, by which he means the Dutch philosopher Baruch Spinoza, on fortitude. We'll take a short break and return and speak more with Ted. Please stay with us.
I know it takes a mess of curry to go against the grain. You have to make great sacrifice for such little gain and so much pain. And if your plans come to nothing, washed out in the rain, let me rekindle all your hopes and help you start again. Because I keep faith, I keep faith, I keep faith, I keep faith in you, yes I do.
And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Ted Stolze is a philosophy professor at Cerritos College, and he taught philosophy and religious studies for a dozen years at what is now California State University, East Bay. And we are talking about an article, and actually it's really a much broader research and academic investigational project he has into the work of Baruch Spinoza, or Baruch de Spinoza, who was born in 1632 and died in 1677. He was a Dutch philosopher born of Portuguese Jewish parents who had fled to Amsterdam to escape persecution. His magnum opus is The Ethics, which was published in 1677. He died in The Hague that year. How political was Baruch Spinoza? I mean, we've been talking about his analysis of emotions, his understanding of things like fortitude and courage and generosity, the distinction he made between passive and active affects or emotions. To what degree Was he politically engaged? And to what extent did he use the kinds of ethical resources he was offering to the world in specifically in political struggle or political activity?
Well, we wouldn't want to characterize Spinoza as an activist. He did have a circle of friends that he met regularly with and discussed philosophy and science, undoubtedly discussed current affairs. When the Dutch Republic was in danger, he certainly supported the leaders of the Republic, the De Witt brothers, but he was not somebody who you would say was engaged in a modern political sense. That was not really something that he perhaps had any expertise, or it was not even something which was possible for him. It is interesting, however, that his Latin teacher, Franciscus van den Enden, was a very committed advocate of radical democratic politics and was in France accused of being a spy and, in fact, executed on a charge that he was participating in a plot to assassinate the King of France. So I'm under the assumption that Spinoza's relationship to his Latin teacher would have been one in which he was exposed to very democratic ideas. In the 17th century, these were ideas that were largely suppressed in Europe, with the exception in the mid-17th century of the English Civil War, in which King Charles I was and his army were defeated by a parliamentary army led by Oliver Cromwell, who in 1649 presided over the execution of King Charles and establishment of a commonwealth that lasted for the length of Cromwell's life, but didn't turn into the kind of democratic republic that I suspect that Spinoza had hoped to see, and other more radical elements within the parliamentary army and within English society had hoped to see. So there was a kind of disillusionment that some have thought occurred, or a waning of Spinoza's enthusiasm for democratic politics. I'm not sure that that's, in fact, the case, but there is a kind of withdrawal of Spinoza from direct political engagement. And yet I think there's sometimes a need for withdrawal to rethink and the ethics and the unfinished last work that Spinoza wrote called A Political Treatise do have strong commitments, I would say, still to thinking of democracy as one in which participation rather than representation is the key identifying feature. There was no freedom of speech in the 17th century, so it would have been very difficult for Spinoza to have openly advocated democracy. The Dutch Republic was governed by a well-meaning elite, and when it was overthrown in the early 1670s, Spinoza was appalled by it and publicly sought to protest it, but his landlady evidently persuaded him to stay at home and not risk the anger of the mobs who were celebrating the overthrow of the Republic and the reestablishment of the House of Orange monarchy. So I don't think you're going to find in Spinoza necessarily a good model of an activist in the way we would understand an activist, but Spinoza's philosophy, I think, and his commitment to democracy in this participatory sense is very useful for contemporary activists.
We've already talked about the pitfalls of acting out of outrage or anger, or maybe the problems with anger and outrage as resources with which to fuel a continuing sort of activism or agitation. What about pity? What did Spinoza think of acting out of pity for others?
Well, Spinoza was not sympathetic to the emotion of pity because it presumed a kind of superiority over the person who is being, or persons who are being pitied. it would be comparable to somebody pitying a homeless person and giving that person a handout, but not really doing anything to identify the causes of homelessness and deal with those structural factors through ordinary politics. The problem with pity is that the one who pities doesn't really try to change the circumstance or circumstances of anyone who is subject to pity. By contrast, Spinoza is not opposed to what we would call compassion, which is to suffer with or be concerned with the well-being and seek to improve the well-being of others. So it's not that Spinoza is an elitist and doesn't want to pity the less fortunate. In fact, there's an egalitarian impulse that it's not enough to feel bad for someone who is suffering. The question is to identify the source of the suffering and to do something about it, to suffer with for the sake of improving the condition of the one who is suffering.
Ted Stoltz joins us on Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. He is professor of philosophy at Cerritos College in Norwalk, California. So how would you sum up your understanding of what Spinoza and his effort to, in part, deal with kind of the fluctuations of human emotions, to deal with the passions that might sway us in ways that aren't helpful to us or the broader society? How would you sum up what Spinoza can offer us and is offering us in terms of fueling and sustaining an enduring radical project, a project in which socialists, stay engaged, and stay with their political struggles?
Well, it was interesting to me to see within the last few years around the Occupy movement and the Indignados movement in Spain and the rise of Syriza in Greece, a kind of generalized phenomenon of pent-up anger and hope for a better world that were deeply moving. And it's hard not to be swept up in that kind of enthusiasm. The difficulty, of course, is to deal with not just the ebbs and flows, but the real economic pressures placed upon, say, the Syriza regime, and the normalization and quieting down of radical expectations. So I think a lot of the Marxists, such as Tony Negri, who have worked on Spinoza and Marx, have rightly emphasized the role of indignation, of anger, as a spur to action. And you find people like Marcuse and Michael Lewy, who have identified a utopian or romantic moment. The problem is either of those initial impulses to activism are not going to ensure that as we live our lives and our friendships and personal lives and other everyday activities, that we can in fact build and sustain and engage in what the labor historian, now lawyer, Staunton Lind referred to as not a sprint, but a long distance running kind of activism. You know, we face the reality that many of the activities in which we're engaged, we won't live to see the fruits of. As we raise children, we have to impart to them basic values. The family, as the philosopher John Rawls once notably said, is a school for justice. So how we transmit values from one historical moment to the next, from the rise and fall of one movement to the next, from one generation to the next. This is, I think, a historic task of the left, of socialists, not just to continue to reaffirm a commitment in the abstract, but to find the deep emotional means by which we persuade people to join in this cause, to participate, to see some vision of a different kind of world. And that slogan, you know, that we want to see a different kind of world, is one that has to reach people at a very deep level. It can't just be an empty slogan. It has to be made concrete in people's lives. And so I think what Spinoza offers, his philosophy has offered, I think to me at least, is a way of thinking not just how we become radicalized initially, either through hope or anger or some combination of the two, but how we can, over the course of our lives, continue to build, continue to hope, continue to think, continue to reach out, join forces with others in new organizations, new parties, new struggles to come. We, again, may not live to see the fruits of our efforts, but we continue in that direction nonetheless.
And again, you would emphasize fortitude and kind of the subcategories of fortitude, which are courage and generosity, as Spinoza's key contributions in this area?
Yes. So I think it's that nuance that he draws between, within emotional life, between the passions of love and hate, hope and fear, for example. And by contrast, there are emotions or affects such as generosity and courage, fortitude, broadly construed, that are, all things considered, more reliable, more stabilizing, more capable of sustaining over the long run the life of an activist or an organizer. But again, I have to insist, I mean, Spinoza famously says there is no state within a state. There is no guarantee that we can master our emotions completely. So he's not suggesting for a moment that struggles will always be successful. He's, I would say, making a case if you are committed to a struggle, you want to be successful in the long run, and you don't want to burn out. You don't want to go down fighting. If the purpose in a struggle is to win, this is a much more effective means to sustain oneself in that struggle. So it's not as though there's a self-help book for the left. I don't think that's what Spinoza is providing, but one needs to be somewhat observant of, reflective of, one's passive emotions, and to the extent that you are, courage, generosity, fortitude are strengthened, and one is better able to sustain this ebb and flow, this fluctuation of emotional and political life.
And for those who've recently joined us, let me just read from my guest Ted Stoltz's article in Rethinking Marxism on Spinoza. Spinoza defines fortitude as, quote, all actions that follow from affects, in other words, emotions, related to the soul insofar as it understands. In one thinker's elegant expression, fortitude is none other than our human, quote, internal power. After having defined fortitude, Spinoza next identifies its constituent affective parts, courage and generosity. He characterizes courage as, quote, the desire by which each one strives solely from the guidance of reason to preserve one's being. And generosity is the name he gives to, quote, the desire by which each one strives solely from the guidance of reason to aid other human beings and join them in friendship. And finally, Ted, another assertion, and this is perhaps what Spinoza is best known for, is that, quote, the natural right of each person extends as far as his or her desire and power, close quote. What does that phrase of Spinoza mean?
Well, Spinoza is a rough contemporary of Thomas Hobbes, the great English philosopher, and overlaps just slightly with the life of John Locke. So he's part of the discussion of social contract theory, as it has come to be called. And what he's concerned with is that even in a society based on, quote unquote, the rule of law or a social contract, that one doesn't thereby abandon one's natural rights by having agreed to live within the society, to abide by the rules, abide by the laws. Those rules, those laws themselves, may at some more fundamental level be illegitimate. So Spinoza preserves for each individual the ability to challenge the rules, the laws that govern one's society, to reinvestigate them. That's very different than Hobbes. Once a social contract has been established, with very rare exceptions, one cannot challenge those rules. They're set in place. So we retain the ability to rethink, to challenge, to debate, to rebel, to resist. Now, the danger, of course, for Spinoza is that one can rebel and resist in unintelligent ways or precipitously or in isolation from having had conversations with others who are like-minded. So there can be very premature, counterproductive means by which one can challenge the prevailing rules and institutions of one's society. But the point for Spinoza is that if we have the desire to change and if we can effectively mount an opposition, then one can pursue that. There's no barrier, there's no transcendent reason why one can't issue that challenge.
And that's Ted Stoltz. He's professor of philosophy at Cerritos College in Norwalk, California. We've been talking about an article he contributed to the journal Rethinking Marxism about Spinoza on the question of fortitude and how that might constitute a kind of ethics for Marxism. That essay will be part of Ted Stoltz's forthcoming book with the title currently Becoming Marxist, Studies in Philosophy, Struggle, and Endurance. That's due out from Brill in 2017. Ted, thanks so much for joining us.
Well, thank you very much, C.S. I really appreciate it.
The music was Billy Bragg singing I Keep Faith. And this is C.S. suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, as Albert Einstein once said. And we hope you'll join us next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources and links, and a way to sign up for our podcast. And check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio.